Welcome to episode 2 of Bibliotech, the podcast about emerging technologies for academics. This podcast is brought to you by University Affairs Magazine. My name is Rochelle Mazar, and I'm an Emerging Technologies Librarian at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. Every month, you can listen in as I talk about what's new in technology and what we as academics should be paying attention to. It's hard to keep up with all the new software, tools, and gadgets. That's where I come in. In this episode, I explore the idea of data storage. What does the future hold when it comes to storing our files in software? Will we continue to save everything on a tangible server, or will we move to cloud computing where everything is stored remotely? I explore both of these potential futures and invite you to decide which would be better, a device that you're in complete control of, or a remote server with unlimited capacity. What do you think the world of tomorrow will be like? The computer you have today has a storage capacity probably larger than all your former computers combined. Digital storage has become cheap to produce and relatively cheap to buy. While it's getting easier and easier to store your own material on these voluminous drives, we're also in the middle of a boom in cloud computing, which lets you store all of your files on web servers rather than on your own computer. Not only that, cloud computing also lets you avoid storing even your software on your computer. You can let the cloud hold all your programs and just sign into them from whatever computer or device you have access to. These two trends represent two potential computing futures, a sort of digital crossroads, each with its pros and cons. Let's say we, collectively, opt to pick one option over the other. Which future would you prefer to see?
The world of tomorrow will be filled with wondrous things. What about life? Your life and mine. Will we change? Will we be happier? You know, some persons contend that the drama of daily life remains constant and will remain so forever. I wonder.
In the first future, the focus is on cheap local storage where the onus is on the individual to keep their software up to date and to keep their data safe. Let's say we all agreed that cheap personal storage was the only option. In this hypothetical computing future, your computer probably lives on your desktop, hooked up to a really good and fairly expensive internet connection. It has massive storage capacity, so massive that it can easily contain several decades worth of TV shows, the entire content of the Library of Congress and the National Archives, and every song you've ever heard, all while sitting comfortably on your desk. You are very conscious of your storage limit, and you looked very carefully at your computer's storage capacity when you bought it. In the past, you have frequently outgrown your computers and had to pare down your data. Your data is important, and paring it down is a painful and tedious process. So instead, you just make sure your digital storage space is like an airplane hangar. When you get close to the limit, you bring your computer to a shop and get a technician to add some more memory to increase your storage capacity. The hardware itself isn't that expensive, but the labor to install it doesn't come cheap. You dare not open the computer up yourself. It's delicate and complicated, and you're not at all familiar with its workings. You also spend significant money on the processors, high-speed ports, and other tech specs. This is your primary computing hub. It is crucial to everything that you do in your life. It's an extension of your brain and contains many of your most precious memories. Your very powerful computer usually stays at home on your desk. It's on almost all the time, unless it's crashed or being repaired. You also have a set of portable devices through which you view, watch, and hear your tremendous store of data. You have an e-book reader, a music player, and a portable device on which you can watch TV and movies. Each of these devices has a substantial storage capacity. You pick and choose which items from your main computer you want to copy onto your devices. You have playlists on your music player, temporary libraries for your ebook reader, and the latest episodes of selected TV shows for your media player. Fortunately, the copyright owners of all this material have relented and have licensed it to be copied onto your portable devices. If they hadn't, it would have been difficult or impossible to read, listen, or watch anywhere other than your home computer. You find that you spend significant time organizing your data and considering what you'll want to read, listen to, and watch in the near future to ensure that you have what you need when you want it. For the most part, the content you have on your computer and your devices is yours to store, organize, or lose. You have a copy, just like you have a copy of a book on a bookshelf. But some of your content uses a different metaphor. You lease some books, journals, and magazines, and the content owners you download it from never entirely give it over to you. They retain the right to pull their content back when they want to, update or modify it, or check in to see how you're using it. You have the copy in your legal possession, but it's as though someone else has slapped a homing device on it. With some leased content, you're allowed to use it only for a limited time. Some of your content is viewable only for a day. Some is available for a week or two. You have several subscriptions that last a year or more. Some of your content is available for your use at any time, as long as you maintain your subscription. If you lapse in your payment, that content is gone. Your main computer is your primary data silo. When it breaks, slows down, or crashes irreparably, which it probably does every 2 to 3 years, you need to transfer all the content you've amassed onto a new computer. If it breaks down and corrupts your data, it's usually lost to you forever. You, me, everyone has their own silo of data that they curate, maintain, and transfer from device to device. And like today, rights owners, like publishers and distributors, don't like the idea of us sharing our silos with each other. We have to pay more if we want to collaborate with others. The default setting is private and secure. In this future, most of the tools you use on your computer are software that you install either through a download or from a disk, the same way it's been for decades. Often that software comes preloaded on your computer when you buy it. We own a copy of that software, and getting a second copy requires payment and a process of installation, which gets easier and faster every year. Software is frequently updated and improved, and that requires us to authorize updates and restart our systems. Many of us ignore these requests, making our computers vulnerable to hackers and errors. When we get a new computer, that software we already own is often incompatible and outdated, and we need to find and buy new versions. In the past, we have used physical media to store our content: paper, wax cylinders, books, records, CDs, and DVDs. The content is recorded on an object that we can touch and hold, an object we can lock up and protect. That metaphor continues in this version of the future, where the content we own is stored digitally on physical media we keep in our homes and cart around with us. If our houses burn down, if our computers and devices are stolen, if we drop them in the dishwater or our kids jump up and down on them, that material is gone. But what if we turn in a different direction, toward the cloud? In this hypothetical future, your computer has a respectable storage capacity, but not enough to carry everything you watch, listen to, read, or create. Rather than a set storage limit built into your computer, you use only the internet for storage, and the only limit you know of is whether or not you remember your password. In competition with each other, the services you use to store your data keep upping the available space, even though you've never known anyone who filled their storage up to the limit. You've never backed anything up, or even really think about backing anything up. You've never lost any content either. As far as you can tell, your digital content is as reliable as the books on your bookshelf. You can access your data from anywhere. Your portable ebook reader can also tap into your TV content, and you can watch entire seasons of TV shows from a screen on the back of a bus seat, the airplane entertainment system, or a friend's house. You read the occasional news story about someone losing their content or their content being sniffed by others. There is some fear that corporations make mistakes that allow this to happen or do it deliberately, but that's largely considered to be conspiracy theories and urban myths. You know there are concerns about privacy, and your answer to that is to make your password weirder and weirder. Your computer is extremely portable, and you have a range of other devices on which you view, listen to, and watch media of various kinds. But in actual fact, all of these devices are empty. They're just ciphers, connecting to a larger repository of data and displaying it to you via a super strong wireless connection. Over time, that connection to the internet has gotten so strong and stable, and your computers and devices are so good at using it, that being offline is a thing of the past. It's easy to imagine that your tiny little e-reader really does contain the entire university library. You can read everything on it, and you have access to millions of books with no delays and no capacity problems. But when there's a power disruption, or if you drop the device and your wireless card blinks out, your device becomes entirely useless to you. Your computer doesn't have much software. When you start it up, it immediately connects to the internet, and most of the tools you use are actually websites. You write papers on tools that are not stored on your computer, though it feels as though they are. They are actually housed on thousands of servers all over the world, where a hardware failure of any single machine will be completely unnoticeable to you. Some of these sites you pay a subscription for. You never own it outright, and if the company goes under, the tool becomes unavailable to you. Some of them are entirely free, but come with conditions. It may watermark your documents or pictures, it might add a logo to your video, or it might display ads you must watch before you can access the material. Most of these tools have at least a minimal version available for free with ads or other restrictions. This means that many people have access to many tools, even if they can't afford them. You only purchase subscriptions to tools you use every day, and use the free versions of things like photo editing and sound editing, which you do infrequently. You're able to do more than you used to, but you're aware that information about you and your habits, in aggregate, are being shared with third parties. Privacy is available to you, but it comes at a cost, and you find yourself negotiating internally about when you need that privacy and when you don't. Your students collaborate and share easily, regardless of their financial status. The range of creative tools available to people of all ages has resulted in a creative boom of mashups, digital art and music, and virtual installations. Access to the means of virtual production has never been easier. Your research data is kept on a cloud server owned by a consortium of universities. You have access to it anywhere, and by agreement, your data is shared with a group of academics across the country who collect and analyze data similar to yours. The moment you added your research data to the university cloud, you had access to their data as well. You have noticed in recent years that more and more work is credited not just to individuals, but to these collective banks of research. After a set time, the data in the cloud becomes available to the public at large, built seamlessly into their own semantic information webs. Often, general internet users employ your research data in their daily lives, sometimes without even being aware that they are. Funding for research has started to grow as more and more public and private institutions find that data useful. You find that you get calls from the media more often than you used to. When your computer breaks or is stolen, your replacement computer looks and feels pretty much the same as the old one. All you need to access your content is a password, or a retina scan, or some other secured method. Your content is available to you from any computer, anywhere in the world. You are aware of the fact that somewhere in the world there is a log of exactly what you download, read, view, and create using your computer and your devices, and that log is a valuable commodity. The cost of all your free, accessible anywhere content and web applications is compromising parts of your privacy. You lose privacy in tiny pieces at a time. One application wants to know how many new documents you create and read. It takes that information in aggregate and the company uses it to estimate its future server load. They also want to know where you are when you view their content. They use that information to display contextual advertising for the businesses and services in your vicinity. Another application wants to know what time of day you log on. Another tracks the links you click on and read, and sells that information to companies who only want to target consumers who will be interested in their products. The downside of this is that you are tagged and targeted by advertisers everywhere you look. The upside is that the advertising you see is highly tailored, relevant to you, and usually only marginally annoying. You understand why you see advertising. This is how you pay for your content. You pay less money than ever before to read, view, or create content, but the cost remains. The currency is your attention. Largely, the web applications and content you use and view are sophisticated, high quality, and useful. Often you click on advertising links as an act of support for the content producers. You know that your value isn't only in your wallet. Granting advertisers access to your attention is one of the ways you can help support artists, developers, and researchers. A purely monetary economy seems quaint and simple to you. This is a complex information universe, and you have learned to trust some content distributors more than others. You pick and choose how you will dole out your attention and how you will compromise your privacy. Many are not so careful, and stories of inappropriate behavior and content created by someone in the wrong place at the wrong time abound. All that data collection has been a boon for academia as well. There has been a rash of interesting research projects in the last few years mining data of this nature, and we have learned a great deal about people's reading, viewing, and content habits. Never before have we known so much about ourselves as we track, record, and process it all through cloud computing. In the present, these two trends are available and in use. Which is better? It's probably neither, of course. The real future will be a mixture of both of these, and it will be up to each of us to determine when personal storage is the best answer to ensure critical privacy, and when the wild collaborative possibilities and innovation of cloud computing are worth any potential risks. I own a 64-gigabyte USB drive. With 64 gigabytes in my pocket, I can carry the next dozen books on my reading list, my entire music library, and all five of the latest seasons of Doctor Who. Because it's a USB key, I can share it with anyone. I can revisit it whenever I like, or I could drop it, break it, or leave it stuck in a library computer and lose it forever. But I also create and store documents online. I keep most of my work documents in Google Apps, where I can access them from my work PC, my home MacBook, my Ubuntu netbook while traveling, or from the public library or a friend's iPad. I can also easily invite my colleagues into those documents, making easy collaboration second nature. I back up the manuscript of my never-finished novel on Dropbox, which syncs the content across all my computers. My calendar doesn't exist in hard copy anymore, or even just on one computer. That data syncs across private networks and into the public realm, making it easy for me to update it, share it, and consult it, no matter where I am. I no longer store every email I've ever gotten on my hard drive. I use a web-based email service and haven't deleted an email message in years. When my computer breaks or I move to a faster, shinier one, all my precious content is at my fingertips in seconds. Am I giving up my privacy? Yes, I am. Administrators of any of these services could, conceivably, intercept and abuse my data. Will I one day see my own half-finished manuscript published under someone else's name? This is actually more difficult to do than you'd think. From the outside, it looks as if you have a folder on a server with your name on it, but in actuality, the data is far more complicated than that, with the files disassembled and encrypted in such a way that anyone looking at a single server, or even a set of them, would be hard-pressed to put anyone's documents back together in a readable format. But human beings are human beings, and surely it's possible, even if technically difficult. And here we get to the heart of it. Cloud computing works largely on reputation and trust. A company is in the business of protecting your data. Their success or failure depends on whether they earn your trust. We can only trust that a company will be honest with us, hire the right people, manage them right, pay them well, and instill in them the same values their website and terms of service project to us. Barring that, we can trust in the power of the crowd. If a company isn't reliable, the bleeding edge will turn from them publicly and loudly. So who is the best custodian of your data? Is it you, with a lock on your front door and your password? Or is it a company dedicated to the task? Few of us are experts at data storage, after all. We don't have access to the skills, knowledge, or server farm that professionals do. But when is it a good idea to trust them with our content? In our digital future, regardless of how much storage we have or how many cloud services we employ, we will be constantly faced with this question. The answer will, and should, differ depending on the content. Not all data needs ironclad security. If it did, our ability to share, mash up, and collaborate would be so compromised as to be non-existent. Our willingness to share some data about ourselves might be the difference between global access to key productive functionality and access by only the wealthy. We will need to get good at assessing our answers to these kinds of questions. The skills to make the best decision between private, personal storage and the use of the cloud will be our next key literacy. That's it for this episode. If you'd like to get in touch with me about something you heard on this podcast, or would like to suggest a topic for a future episode, please post a comment at the bottom of the page where this podcast is posted at universityaffairs.ca. Until next time, I'm Rochelle Mazar.